Hey, it's Mark Farrell. How you feeling out there? It's the Progressive Radio Network. The show is Inside. Happy Thursday to you. It's raining again in New York City. It beats the hell out of snow. And you know what? It's a little less sunny in the world today. Without the little ball of sunshine of Mary Tyler Moore. Mary, you will be missed. Great show coming your way. So, cyber hacking, man. Oh, my God. It's everywhere. Ubiquitous. So we're going to have an expert in here. T.L. Williams, a former CIA operative who ran human intelligence operations. Imagine that, having that on your business card in Asia and Europe for over 30 years. Knows what the threat means to our interests here in the U.S. and abroad, and the techniques used by cyber spies and what it really means to be a spy. And we can ask him if the 002 trinkets and toys that Roger Moore and everyone else used were possibly close to being true. Anyway, great show coming your way. First thing I have to say, yeah, we're broadcasting live from New York City, the city that can call its home to over 150 people from countries all over the world. Mr. Trump, 150 countries worldwide reside right here in New York City. And that's a great thing that we're very proud of, always have been very proud of. It's the melting pot, the tapestry of New York City and the world, the microcosm right here. So with all the hoo-ha that Donald Trump has been bringing into office almost 1 week today, tomorrow will be 1 week, the inauguration, it's wreaking havoc. It's really, really reaching a boiling point. People are really pissed off, and I think this is absolutely nothing yet. I'm very happy about Mayor de Blasio's statement a couple weeks ago. They actually started something in New York City, I'm not sure how many years ago, but basically they had everyone's name and address who was not a legal immigrant, and it was a volunteer program for ID cards, things of that nature. And once this got out and Trump announced his plans, New York City, started getting nervous, Mayor de Blasio, and wanted to protect the people who are residing here illegally. So I believe they went to court. The last I heard that the judge ordered the city of New York to not purge the resident information in terms of where they actually resided. Because Mayor de Blasio was concerned about certainly repercussions if this law becomes policy, that they could be dragnetted and taken out of the country. So I applaud Mayor de Blasio and certainly other governors and mayors across the country for doing that. As a matter of fact, Cuomo said the other day, if you're going to dragnet immigrants, start with me. So I'm glad to see that there's certainly a lot of people standing up for what they believe in, human rights. I mean, what is this nation if it wasn't for immigration? And I believe me, I understand that people should come in legally, but to rip people out of their homes who are possibly working, contributing to the economics of this country, certainly if they're criminals, pose a threat, yes, deport them. Like Obama deported, I forget how many millions during his term. In 8 years, I think the highest of any sitting president. So it happens, and it has been happening, certainly to this degree. We don't want to see happen. And the wall, that brings me to the wall. So the wall, if you ask any, and I've read information about this, any person in the service, generals, colonels, walls do not prevent things from happening. Walls only are logistical, temporary impediment, I should say. So walls are not the answer. And his latest thing is that we are, the taxpayers, Trump is saying that we are going to be paying for this wall because Mexico's like, hey, hasta la vista, baby. We're not paying for this wall that you want. Oh, my God. Anyway, I was really happy to see the other day Women's March becoming the largest organized rallies across the nation. It's just great on so many levels to see the solidarity, the camaraderie of people who are just fed up of the rhetoric and possibly what could lie down the road. I mean, this, the sexism, the racism, the misogyny, the ableism. I never even knew that was a word, ableism, which is so true. Obviously, the president making fun of the New York Times reporter and other people and so much more. So it was great to see people out, the millions and millions and millions of people in droves, men, women, children, to show the new administration that this is serious business here. You can't mess with us here. And there's going to be a great resistance about that. I mean, when he's talking about defunding Planned Parenthood, reverse Roe v. Wade, and something I heard about this morning, I don't want to misspeak about this, but something about other countries mentioning abortion. So now we can fine other countries or not do trade or have commerce with them. I mean, this is just ludicrous on so many different levels. But it's interesting to see how people's personalities, and maybe you witnesses at work, maybe your colleagues, maybe family members, etc., are either becoming more vocal, whether it's socially, online, or actually taking a stand and perhaps taking part in the Women's March, or actually just saying, I just don't know what to do. I'm just kind of going to wait for the next 4 years, or maybe he'll be impeached. And, there's so much information out there. As a matter of fact, on the weekends, I just have to turn it off. I cannot fill my brain with any more the Trump talk. The appointees, the 16 appointees that are really, for a good portion of them, a reflection of Wall Street. And our guest, T.L. Williams, will be talking about some of that in a few minutes because the new CIA appointee, Pompeo, what is his resume? How does that qualify him to be the new director of the CIA versus John Brennan? And I understand the political appointee ramifications, et cetera, but Mike Pompeo as the new CIA director, it doesn't make any sense. A lot of the appointees, the 16 appointees, are clearly misappointed by all means. So this is kind of a cool story. Imagine being a performer in a hotel lobby in Anaheim, and you got some good chops. You're hanging out. You got a little crowd going, and you're singing Stevie Wonder's Superstition, and all of a sudden, guess what? The man himself comes up on the stage.
Here we go. One, two, three, King. Clap your hand.
That's a good thing, too, because he forgot the words, Grayson Earhart. So Stevie helps him out.
Way to go, Grayson Earhart. Yes. Can you imagine being up on stage and Stevie Wonder, you're singing his song and he appears out of nowhere. Wow, that's incredible.
And of course, I would forget the lyrics as well, but Stevie was a great sport. And here he is on stage, Stevie Wonder. Of course, he's blind and realizes he picks up on the fact that this young singer who's gifted didn't know the lyrics and was leaning over and doesn't know. I guess he's so in tune with sound and proximity that he would just lean over and just whisper a lyric or two in his ear and lean back, and he would tilt the mic back to Grayson, bring it back to himself, back and forth. And I just think that's a great display of somebody who's an icon in the business, who is never too big to hang out with a common musician, someone who, who knows how far this guy will go in life, Grayson. I wish him all the best and success and stardom and success, to his full desire. But for him to hang out with Stevie Wonder, and Stevie Wonder, more importantly, to give this guy the time of day
for a great performance. It's nice. That's what it's all about. And the fact that Stevie Wonder, and I don't think you could hear this, it wasn't too prominent in the audio there, was talking about the Women's March and how powerful it is and how significant the cause is and how collectively we have to stand up together and face issues of this caliber, which we need to do. So I really dig news like that. And you know what? And with all the muck that's out there in the last, I'd say, 6 months, more importantly, in the last 7 days, I should say, more of an example, it's just great to see, you know, things like that happen. And one more thing I want to quickly mention, and hopefully some of this stuff is just administrational and will be tweaked and overturned. But as soon as Obama left the White House, Trump was sworn in. The disability page on the White House website, boosh, gone. Interesting, right? Excuse me. Interesting. So, I mean, was this is this part of the protocol? I mean, do pages get taken down to get, you know, reviewed or snuffed up to change the verbiage? I'm not sure. But obviously, with Trump's track record, it gives one pause to think, like, you know, obviously, you know, his feeling for people with disabilities. He's totally insensitive, not empathetic, and he's callous. Among many, 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 many other adjectives. So so we need to, I will keep you posted because I would like to have your support. You know, as a disability advocate, we fight for the rights for people with disabilities. We fight for the rights of all people on this planet. And if you have any information, please, you can give us a call here at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, or Mark and Mark Farrell Motivation.com. Email me, Mark and Mark Farrell Motivation.com. So his new book is called Zero Day, China's Cyber Wars. T.L. Williams, known as Terry, he's been cyber hacking his first, becoming our enemy's preferred method to launch attacks against our country. Recent cyber attacks by Russia and China. As a matter of fact, you think about the funny one that actually kind of happened with Sony. I mean, with all the insider leaks that we read about, that was pretty funny. It's still bad, but, you know, how susceptible we are to the economy, political institutions, and our democracy, this is huge. I mean, this is the world that we live in. He retired from active duty with the CIA in 2009, and I'm really happy that it's brought T.L. Williams to my show. Good morning, T.L.
Good morning, Mark. Thank you for having me.
How's the weather in Florida, my friend?
It's awesome. I mean, we're looking at 75 today, light breezes off the coast. I had my window open as I was sitting up here writing just a few minutes ago.
Okay, the hell with you.
Sorry about that.
May I call you Terry?
Please.
Okay, Terry, before we commence with this interview, I have one significant question for you.
All right. Let's hear it.
Is this a secure line?
Absolutely.
What is a secure line? Is there such a thing?
You never really know who's listening in.
So you were in the CIA for 30 years. That's correct. What was your initial appeal to become part of the Central Intelligence Agency?
Well, you know, it's interesting. My wife and I had completed a master's degree in teaching English as a foreign language. And we spent several years working in Iran and Japan and Guatemala. And the nature of the work was we were bouncing around a lot, and we wanted to start a family, and it just didn't seem like it was going to be a very stable career. So we liked the idea of living and working abroad and started looking at some of the different foreign affairs agencies. And I actually saw an ad in the Herald Tribune, and they were recruiting in those days. This was the late 70s, early 80s. And went in and applied, and boom, a year later, I was walking through the front door of the CIA. So not a lot of heavy thought went into the initial process, but I grew into the job after being there for 30 years.
What was the most compelling aspect of that work that kept you there for 30 years?
Well, the chance to make a difference. Mm. You know, it's interesting. We were mostly in Asia, and we were mostly China-focused, so that was kind of a natural driver for me to write this most recent book. But just an incredible group of people dedicated to the mission. And people from all aspects of life, all disciplines. I used to tell people you could find a career at CIA, you know, with virtually any job description that started with A or ended in Z. I mean, it was just an amazing place.
So
astronomers, botanists, zoologists, I mean, you name it. You could have almost any skill set and find a position there and do meaningful work.
Except for a radio talk show host.
Well,
hey, you never know.
Almost any.
They may have their internal podcast. Who knows?
Yeah, well, they certainly have internal newsletters and things
sure.
like that. And yeah.
So your character that you developed for you, this is your third book, correct? Zero Day?
Right.
Is Logan Alexander. How much of your life is reflected in the character Logan?
You know, I see bits of myself in Logan. When I first developed Logan, he was a Navy SEAL. And a lot of the action in actually the first two books sort of was Middle East. It was Iran. And it was driven by, you know, my being really upset about Iran's role as a major supporter of terrorism and what was happening with a lot of our troops with IED attacks. And we had lived in Iran. We lived in Isfahan, Iran, for 2 years, actually teaching English to members of the Shah's Imperial Army Aviation Helicopter Corps. And that was an amazing experience. I really had a great time there. This was obviously pre-1979 revolution. But so Logan kind of developed in that environment, and I had grown up myself as a never serving in the military, but grew up on military bases. My dad was military. And then obviously the experiences that I had at CIA working with military, training military, supporting the military, it kind of all morphed together into this character.
What was your main role with the CIA for that bulk of your time there?
I was an operations officer. You know, one of the key missions that the CIA has is to provide human intelligence, and the way you get human intelligence is recruiting human beings to provide it to. And so a lot of people find that unsavory, even people who make it past the recruitment process into CIA and they're out on their first tour and you tell them that their job is to go out and recruit agents to provide intelligence. They kind of go, what? So you need to be clear about what you're doing. So basically that's it. It's recruiting human targets and collecting intelligence from them.
It seems that there would be a lot of psychology involved.
Well, there is. You have to really understand people and their motivation and how to motivate people. The agency uses a process called a recruitment cycle to spot, identify, assess, develop, and recruit and handle agents. And, you know, I would say there is many motivations for someone wanting to be involved in intelligence work, as there are, well, maybe not as many as there are people, but certainly every person has a motivation, a different motivation, and you have to be able to tap into that. Sometimes it's revenge, and that plays in this book, in Zero Day. Our Chinese volunteer is really upset with the Chinese government because it's corrupt, and it kind of brought down his father, who was a respected former military officer, and he wants to get back for the way his father was treated. So his way of doing that is reaching out to the Americans and asking them if they're interested in cooperating with him. So revenge is a big one.
Absolutely. Terry, now, within the last 15 years, what was your take and perspective on the development of the web? And then seeing it getting bigger and bigger, the digital medium taking over, obviously companies switching over, putting pretty much their lifeline online. And then inevitably, how was the CIA on top of this as the other agencies? Were they behind or were they just doing a good job? Or how would you kind of sum up their ramping up with the times, and were they doing a good enough job then and now?
Well, certainly, when I went into the agency in 1980, the machine that was sitting on my desk was a a Wang. I don't know if you even know what a Wang is, or it was a word processor.
It sounds like an anatomical part, but that's okay.
Yeah, it was just a sort of sophisticated typewriter. It couldn't think, it couldn't do anything for you. It just made it easier to process what you were writing. And so we were kind of in tandem doing the same thing the private sector was doing as more computing power became available and more technology was available. The agency was adapting that. And so within internally certainly had very sophisticated capabilities as they developed. And, I think if you look at what's happened, say, in the last couple of years, John Brennan's reorganization of the agency was one big part of that was bringing in something called it was a Department of Digital Innovation. And I think he obviously felt that maybe we were starting to lag behind, or maybe there were areas where we could really do more. And I haven't been there for a few years, so I'm not really privy to what that organization looks like, but I think it's intended to give CIA officers access to the best that's out there technologically today for both their internal work and to understand what's happening outside in the foreign world and domestic world here.
Now, is there one particular branch? I'm sorry about that, Terry. Is there one particular branch, the CIA versus FBI, who are more in charge of cyber attacks to our government?
Well, I think what you'll find is that there are more. Organizations within all of the national security agencies who have a cyber piece. Where the CIA and the FBI differ is that the FBI is responsible for domestic events, domestic intelligence, as it were, in the U.S. The CIA has responsibility for foreign intelligence. The problem I think you oftentimes run into is that things that are coming over cyber networks could originate in the foreign field, and if it's an attack coming into the U.S., then suddenly it's in the U.S. So, the agencies sometimes have trouble differentiating between who has responsibility and who's going to take the lead on it. But there's pretty good cooperation now. CIA and FBI have a memorandum of agreement that allows them to, at high levels and working levels, work these kinds of things out and not sort of stumble around trying to figure out who's got the lead on it.
T.O. Williams is my guest. He's written a new book, Zero Day, China's Cyber Wars. And I have to ask you, what is your take on the new CIA director, Mike Pompeo?
It's interesting. I've never met Mike, but if you look at his resume, the guy's a bright guy. Apparently, obviously he went to West Point, he went to Harvard, he served his nation and in the Army, and he comes into the job with some experience dealing with intelligence because of his role on the HPC, and I think he was also on a select committee on Benghazi. So he's dealt with the intelligence community before. Now, that's not always necessarily a prescription for success. We've had, you look back a few years, Porter Goss was a former congressman, ended up at the agency as director. Mixed reviews on how that went. He obviously didn't understand the sort of the workforce there.
He wasn't there that long, correct, Terry?
I don't remember what his tenure was. I think it was a couple of years, two to 3 years, something like that. So the thing with Pompeo or any director is they serve at the leisure of the president. Mm-hmm. And the thing that is troubling to me right now, and I think to a lot of intelligence professionals, is that this new president hasn't really demonstrated a lot of understanding or respect for intelligence. And so I'm not really sure how effectively he's going to use CIA. I've heard speculation that he might try to turn the place into, something like what we had during the Vietnam War, where it's more paramilitary operations than a human collection and analysis organization. We've kind of gone down that road a little bit post 9/11. A lot of actually a lot of CIA officers coming in can expect to spend their first tour in, you know, in war zones or in places like, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan. And that tends to change the culture of a place.
Sure.
No. So, and that comes at a cost too, because oftentimes you're not getting a lot more resources when you're standing up those kinds of capabilities, and you're drawing away, certainly on the personnel side, you're drawing people away from your core human collection mission and putting them into that. So something's got to give somewhere. Pompeo's got his work cut out.
Oh, absolutely. Trump has been in office for less than a week, and obviously it's very early to tell. But it seems like there's been a lot of splintering, obviously, with all the comments and statements and decrees and executive orders that have happened in the last 6 days. But is it possible, if it is possible at all, that the new CIA director, Mike Pompeo, could sort of act in a within the confines of the CIA in a covert manner in terms of splintering away, obviously answering to the president and what he needs done and requires that the CIA do, but in terms of being more of a sorry, I'm not articulating well, but just spearheading different initiatives on his own without the actual president knowing it.
No, that doesn't work. And particularly in this case, I don't think it's going to work very well because, you know, the National Security Council plays a really big role in sort of the overall intelligence mission. The way a director typically in the past has set priorities and the way they kind of filter out to the different agencies is he has a senior president's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. It's typically made up of illustrious individuals from industry, from former, you know, cabinet secretaries, people like that.
Sure.
And they come together early in an administration and throughout an administration and advise the president on sort of what the big issues are and what, you know, where the focus might be. And they take that and distill it down, and then it kind of, you know, gets worked out to the agencies depending on what the particular issue is. So, you know, you can't have a rogue director who's out there working issues on his own, and you know, and that's not going to be known by the National Security Council director or the president. That, you know, that really doesn't fly. What you need to have is you need to have a director who's not afraid to speak truth to power. And you know, I get the impression, I mean, from some of the things that Pompeo said in his confirmation hearings. Sounded, you know, it sounded good. It sounded right. But, you know, when the metal meets the road kind of thing, is he going to be able to stand up to Trump when Trump wants to do something stupid like, you know, start waterboarding or whatever again? You know, will he be able to stand up to him and say, sir, that is, one, it's illegal, and it goes against our, you know, what we stand for ethically as a country? Well, you know, we'll see. I'm sure he's going to be tested pretty early on in his tenure.
Seems that. Terry, it seems that any CIA, former CIA employee that has to or wants to publish has to go through the protocol of getting clearance to the CIA. Obviously, they have to find out if you're declassifying or exposing any sensitive information, et cetera. But apparently your book, Zero Day, your new book, Zero Day, China's Cyber Wars, was delayed even longer. Why is that?
You know, that's a good question. I keep asking myself that. You know, my first two books were published or really approved by the Publications Review Board at CIA within 30 days, which is a standard period of time. This one took close to 2 years. And I was being stonewalled pretty much all through the process, not getting any really clear indication of what the problem was, although, you know, I even went up to Washington and met with people a couple of times to see if we could work something out. They forced me to go through an appeal process. There's a standardized appeal process. It's like a three-level process. And at the very end, your appeal is submitted to the executive director of the agency. And I never really got a firm, you know, sort of a response as to what was the issue. They asked me to change a few small things, which I did. But in retrospect, when I thought about it, You know, in 2015, President Obama and Chinese President Xi Jinping were negotiating a bilateral no-hack pact, which was designed to lessen or eliminate hacking against economic targets on both sides. So, you know, it may have been that it would have been uncomfortable to be having that happening and then having a book come out that slammed China for attacking on one level. And then the other thing that I thought of was that I was told several times, that, hey, Terry, the Chinese are watching you, and they're going to think that whatever you're talking about in the book is what we're doing. And I said, come on. I had some senior jobs at the agency, but I wasn't a public person or somebody that the Chinese would be looking at. Although early in my career, they figured out who I was. Well, it's interesting. I was working on my author website one day, and I was looking at how many hits I was getting on my website. I had like 1,000 hits that month, and 10% of them came from China.
Interesting.
So I thought, well, maybe there's some merit in that argument.
Yes.
That they're keeping an eye on me. Who knows?
Well, I think the things that you mentioned, the two big items there, are certainly plausible.
I mean, it's the only thing I could come up with. I'm really cautious when it comes to when I begin my writing process. The fact that something is out in the world, out in the open, let's say, it could have been an accident or an improper disclosure, and I don't feel comfortable using that in my writing just because it's out there. You know, the intelligence community would prefer that information that comes out that way not be perpetuated. I'll give you a good example. During the Clinton years, somebody was in a congressional hearing, and they revealed the fact that the U.S. and China had an agreement to monitor Russian ICBM launches from a couple of sites in western China. Now, at the time, this was not known widely outside of government or certainly outside a very restricted area. And I'm sure the Chinese were embarrassed by it, because they and the U.S. were going after, a fellow communist country, a neighbor of theirs. And if I had been writing at that time, I wouldn't have felt comfortable using that information. But let's take something like a kind of what would be considered a sensitive tradecraft, a surveillance detection run. Your listeners may not know that a surveillance detection run is something that all intelligence services use when they're going out to do something covert. They want to make sure they're not being followed. So they kind of put themselves through some hoops and bells and whistles to make sure that there's nobody back there. Well, if you look, even though that's a sensitive tradecraft method, if you look on Google surveillance detection run, you'll get 300,000 hits in less than a second. So it's out there, it's talked about, it's widely known, it's part of the lexicon, and so I feel comfortable talking about it when I'm writing.
Sure.
That's just kind of two extremes of how you approach it.
So, Terry, with your 30 years of experience researching this book material, and in light of what's been happening in the last 2 years in cyber warfare, do you think this is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of what's to come in terms of device hacking and whether it's corporate espionage, countries just being, what's going on with Russia? I mean, I believe this is just the very early stages of what we're going to encounter.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, the problem is you've got all kinds of hackers out there. You've got nation states, sovereign states, you've got pariah states, you've got criminals, you've got lone wolves, you've got terrorists, and there's no way you can regulate that. I think they've tried in a couple different places. I was just talking about the bilateral agreement that we had with China. And by the way, most people gave that zero chance of success. But in fact, FireEye, which is a cybersecurity company that analyzes things like this, did some analysis post-treaty, and they figured out that China really had reduced its hacking against U.S. economic interests considerably, although they were still doing some hacking in that area, prime targets. You know, we don't have what I guess I would call, you know, the equivalent of a strategic arms treaty for cyber. You know, back in the day when it was Russia and the U.S. and we knew where all the weapons were and we could, you know, there was mutually assured destruction, we would, you know, keep tabs on each other pretty well and you knew. But with cyber, how do you do that? Because of the number of players that I just described. So they've tried some things internationally. I know the UN has a group out there called, it's a group of government experts who are trying to establish norms for international cyber activity. I think there are about 20 governments, including the U.S. and China, that have agreed to these norms. But you know, how do you implement that? How do you determine intent when you get, you know, there's a cyber attack that happens? Or the potential lethality? Are they just doing a probe to figure out if they could do it, they wanted to, and then, you know, down the road they're going to do it? So I think what you have to have is there's got to be more education, more awareness, more buy-in, at least here in the U.S., for us to be able to stand up against this kind of stuff.
And of course,
they're going to keep coming.
Sure, absolutely. And therein lies the irony. We're doing the same thing, trying to infiltrate other countries.
Yeah. I mean, any nation that is as advanced as ours or China has the tools, the offensive and defensive tools to use them in any way that they see fit. And, nation states do these things for their own interests. One of the reasons I think China hacks is to gain an economic advantage a lot of times. It's, you can cut down your research and development costs if you can just hack into a U.S. defense firm and steal their technology, go back, and your time to getting your product to market is shortened considerably, your cost is shorter. That may be one rationale. I mean, you know, another one might be, let's go after our dissident population or just even the average Chinese citizen. We don't want them to have access to the New York Times, for example, or whatever it is. They'll hack into, web hosting sites in the U.S. that have that kind of content on it, strictly for the purpose of denying that content to their citizens.
Or falsifying or making fake news content.
Oh, yeah, that's amazing, isn't it? I mean, if you have readers or listeners who are not astute or not sophisticated, and they
buy right into it, sure.
Oh, how many times have you gotten an email from a friend saying, "Wow, did you see this?" And it's some just salacious thing that doesn't ring true.
Sure.
And you go and snopes it or whatever, and it's just junk.
Now, is this something that could also work in our favor? Obviously, they'd have to be very careful how it's couched, but in terms of just creating or allowing yourself to be hacked and not in an obvious or evident way, that you would be able to give information that would be false.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, and in fact, people do operations in which they will allow, let's say, China to come in and hack. And it's mainly not so much to put out false information, which, you could do, but to kind of analyze, to get good analytics on their methodology and the tools they're using. So, you can always learn something from it, and hopefully it's something that, the term I learned this summer, or rather last summer at a conference I went to was nuke and pave. It's not a situation where you have to go in and nuke your whole system and pave over it because it's been such a disaster. But rather, it's something that, you've controlled in an environment where none of your really important information is going out the door. That's the thing I would mention, actually. It came out of the cyber conference I went to at MacDill Air Force Base last fall. Most of the cyber professionals, and I don't profess to be a cyber professional. I mean, I know enough to just make myself dangerous, I think, really. But, it's the whole idea of I lost my train of thought. Where was I going with that?
The cyber professionals, in terms of there are a certain group out there.
Oh, man, I just lost it. Sorry.
That's all right. It happens. It's all that sun you're getting in Florida.
It's, see, it's coming. Baking the brain out here.
Well, you know, it's a scary thought that what's out there, what's potentially possible. But, you know, it almost seems like this material can write itself. I mean, obviously, the person in the White House right now, you know, you can't create this. You can't even make this content up. But when you think of your new book, Zero Day, China's Cyber Wars, I mean, the capability to write plots and are really just the sky's the limit in terms of availability and creativity.
Exactly. I mean, a lot of this is rooted in reality. People tell me, boy, you know, I read your book, and I could be reading sort of the cyber page in the New York Times or something like that. And the thing that I try to do with my books, they're fiction. I mean, it's, you know, it's not a scholarly work or anything like that, but they take real-world issues, sort of security threats that we're facing, and kind of put them into layman's language so that, you know, the average person can be sensitized to these national security threats and maybe think about it in a way that they haven't before and realize that, yeah, the sky's the limit in terms of the kind of creativity that that our foes are likely to throw at us.
And Terry, finally, if you were to do it all over again, and the landscape was currently the way it is right now, would you like to sink your teeth into this type of international crime that takes place?
In what sense?
In cyber world, cyber warfare.
You mean would I sort of from a professional perspective?
Correct.
You mean?
Correct.
Oh, you know, I don't think I'm that technically adept.
If you had the opportunity.
There are opportunities. That was one of the things that surfaced at this conference that I attended. I mean, there are literally tens of thousands of these cybersecurity jobs going begging because we just we haven't trained up the workforce to do it. Great opportunities. I think it would be amazing, actually. But I'm more I'm the kind of person that likes to get up from my desk and be outside doing stuff. I'm not sure, you know, I would be suited. Even though my writing does that to me, makes me sort of sit at the computer for
that's
a few
what
hours
it does.
A day. I don't want to be doing it for, you know, 10 or 12 hours a day. I'd rather be outside, you know, skulking around looking for somebody.
Zero Day, China's Cyber Wars, available now and published by who, Terry?
First Coast Publishers.
And online, what's your website, Terry?
My website is tl-williams.com.
TL-Williams.com. Terry, thank you so much for your time and insight and for your service to the country. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you for what you do. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. And take a dip for me, will you?
Okay, will do.
Have a great day.
Take care.
My name is Mark Farrell. The show is Insight right here on the Progressive Radio Network. Love to hear your feedback at 888-874-4888. You know, it's funny, even just little things like when you go into a McDonald's or a Dunkin' Donuts or any little cafe, Starbucks, and they're like, oh, free Wi-Fi. It kind of makes me laugh because who uses free Wi-Fi? I mean, you're so at risk at exposing yourself and putting yourself out there. I just don't get it, but a lot of people do use it anyway. So I want to bring to you my next guest who is doing something very unconventional. How many of you do the what ifs? If only I had gone to college or gone a master's in this or taken job X, Y, or Z or, you know, gone a different path in life, or if I could just get out of this miserable job that I have right now, I would do what I've meant or what I was born to do. Maybe it's be on the radio. Maybe it's just pack it all in and just quit your job, sell your car, move it on, and just follow your passion in life. And therefore, I want to introduce Tim Fitzgerald. Tim is a licensed clinical social worker specializing in adult children of alcoholics, adult children of dysfunction. I'm raising my hand there, and I'm raising my hand again. And Tim has decided to look on the other side of the fence where hopefully the grass is greener. Hey, Tim, how are you, my friend?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on, Mark.
My pleasure, my friend. So I commend you for being young, and astute and listening to your inner voice and saying, you know what, I like what I'm doing, but I think there's something out there greater that's going to make me happier and where I'm going to have a greater impact for people.
Yeah, absolutely. It's I think follow your heart before, and that's what I'm just trying to honor that.
Now, for the last couple of years, you've been impacting people's lives, working in rehabs, recovery centers for people with drug and alcohol issues. And I believe also you work with some senior populations now. And you're a young man, early 30s. I think you're very good at your craft. Spoken to you before in terms of your disposition, your intelligence level, and your compassion for people and love for obviously making people healthier and happier. Now, what is it that actually drove you at sort of a young age, which is actually a wise thing because you have kind of less to lose if the chips didn't go your way? But what was the epiphany you had and what made you say, you know what, this is something I'm really going to chase?
Sure. Well, first off, I want to thank you for the compliment. I will take it.
Hey, that in 275 will get you a subway ride, my friend.
I won't deny compliments. So I think it's just that what this trip is, it's just a product of years of traveling consistently and just having that encouragement from the family and a larger family structure where I see cousins traveling. We would do surf trips. My father would always be talking about there's a sale on an international flight. So I think it's those different supports along the way kind of led to this moment that I evolved slowly towards taking a journey where I don't have a return flight.
I love it. That makes a good t-shirt. I don't have a return flight. What initially drew you to the field of psychology?
Sure. So I was a market research analyst, and I thought, I want to make a lot of money, and I think marketing is the path. And what I was finding is that I was dreading going to work every single day. And this actually ties into the travel. 2008, I lose my job. Our office laid off probably 20% of the employees. So I was trying to find work, and it just wasn't happening. And I spent months upon months. And I thought, all right, well, here's an opportunity to do something. So I called my friend up, who's also a surfer, and I said, do you want to take a trip? And it turns out he was going after his MBA. He was going to leave his job and get his master's in business administration. They said, sure, I have a gap. Let's do it. So we traveled for 3 months together to Fiji, Australia, New Zealand, and Bali.
And you came back.
I came back. And
that's commendable.
It's not easy. And what I found with this travel is sometimes it's harder coming back than it is going, even if it's on familiar territory.
Sure.
So just to answer your question, what drew me to it, you know, I'd always been told I'd be a good teacher. I guess people could see my demeanor, something about me, mm-hmm. let them know I could guide people in some way, shape, or form. And I didn't want to be a teacher, but I thought they were right. So I'd spoken with a family friend who was a family therapist, asked him what he did and what the job requires, and I realized that's a natural fit for me. So within a week, I looked up grad schools and pursued my master's in social work.
Fantastic. Good for you. Have you always been somebody who's always had like a mind-body connection or are very self-aware?
That's interesting. I think I've always honored my intuition. Mm-hmm. So I hear people say, oh, this happened and I can't believe it, or I got so lucky when they have good fortune. But I've always felt like when positive things happen in my life, that they're just meant to be. So I'd say it's just more of a lack of fear thing and just a trust that everything's going to be okay. So that's, I'd say, yeah, that mind-body connection. If that's a mind-body connection or a connection to something greater, I think for me it's just always been there.
And that coupled with preparation and research, which, as you're doing, I believe you're leaving in less than a week. And that's what you're going to be doing. So tell us about the program that you'd like to institute in a perfect world abroad.
Sure. So right now I'll be traveling to Vietnam to begin with. Where I go from there, I don't know.
I love it.
I usually set out a skeleton plan of what I'm going to do and then let the gaps get filled in along the way. But the idea is I'm a therapist. So I help people identify their pain and release their pain. And I traveled to Thailand a year ago, and I sat in the middle of a field the first day I got there. And I sat cross-legged, overlooking a very large Buddhist temple. And tears just started pouring out of my eyes, and I just felt grounded and just magnetized to that earth there. And I felt like, okay, this is a place I can heal. And from that moment, I thought, wouldn't it be fun to just make my passion travel and therapy? Can I make that into a career? And so the idea is to just take people on 8 to 10 night trips to Thailand to have them get that experience, get some yoga in, get some tourist activities in, and then run a 1 or 2 hour group therapy session at night.
It sounds like a good marketing and business plan to me.
I think
this day and age that we're living in begs for something of that nature, because it's all about being self-aware. People are being the connection between mind and body, as we mentioned, is never been more prominent and more accepted, I think, culturally in our country. And especially with our current administration, I think more and more people are going to need yoga with heavy medication. Well, natural, of course, from the ground up.
You know, it's interesting. I see how people avoid feelings in a lot of ways, and I was seeing that I do it even in ways that aren't so obvious, like exercise. And for me to be still and to meditate, it was much more intense than I realized. But after doing it for a while, being present and still, I was able to manage my feelings better. And I have friends who live and work in New York City. And when I see them, their minds are always racing. And I can feel that. And, you know, one of the ideas was, okay, can we go to a place where we can just let go of all that stuff and just focus on the self? And going to Asia just represents that opportunity where staying still is accepted and it's not shameful, and clocks really aren't abundant there. There's just a different time orientation in Asia, in my experience. And it seems like fertile grounds for personal development and spiritual development. That's really what brought me into it and why I thought, I want to share this gift with others.
Sure. You mentioned something interesting I wanted to target in on, hone in on. I mean, many of us work in hustle and bustling cities, listening to this broadcast in Hong Kong, in Sydney, Australia, wherever people are listening in the world, and don't have much of a choice, you know, because they're committed financially, et cetera, mortgages, obligations, children, husbands, wives, not to leave the hustle and bustle. So as a therapist, is it possible to... Yes, you can work that 10, 12, whatever hour a day and be having racing thoughts, et cetera, but allow yourself that timing to calm and to have that tranquil period to kind of refresh and reinstate yourself.
So the question is, I'm sorry, I just didn't get the question.
Oh, hell, I don't know. It was too damn long. I forgot myself. No, I'm just kidding. Now, is it possible? Now, is it possible that no matter how busy and crazy your life is, no matter where you live on this globe, that you can still have peace and tranquility as long as you give yourself the allotted time?
Well, sure. I think it's how do we take care of ourselves? habits? What do we eat? What's our sleep pattern like? What's our alcohol or drug consumption like? What does our routine look like? And does our routine look like it's geared towards good, positive health and slowing down and being present? Or is it just the opposite? And just like people who may take care of their fitness, what I see is they're doing it consistently. They may not spend hours upon hours at the gym, but they will get to the gym on almost a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that nice base. It's almost like there's an old Indian proverb I just thought of this morning, and I don't know it verbatim, but it's essentially like this. You know, you have many doors in your mind, and you have to open at least several of them every day, if not to give great thought and depth, but at least to air them out.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so what I found with just the hustle and the bustle and how do you just calm down and have some peace, I'd say it requires discipline. And what I found with myself is I've committed to meditating for 15 to 20 minutes every morning. If I did that just once in a while, I don't think I'd receive benefit.
Sure.
But, just like going to the gym consistently. If I meditate consistently, my days are going to look different, and I'm going to approach things with a lot less anxiety.
Oh, absolutely.
And be able to be much more just responsive versus reactive.
The gym and working out is my temple. It's my church. It's my solace. It's my yoga studio. It's everything, and it keeps me at peace. And my wife knows if I haven't gotten there for 2 or 3 days, she's like, you need to go.
It can show up immediately.
Oh, absolutely. Tim Fitzgerald, we're almost out of time, but lastly, what is the feedback? Are you getting a lot of people who want to live vicariously through you, your friends, your colleagues saying, wow, you're packing it in, you're selling your car, you're giving up your apartment and you're going for it. What's the opinion?
Sure. Highly varied. And what I found is that... I've heard I'm crazy. I heard I'm envious.
You're wasting your money on all your master's program and becoming an intern and resident, et cetera.
Sure. And when you key it in, I hear either two things, fear or excitement.
Mm.
And the response of the fear is what's going to happen? What if? The excitement is we want to hear more about it. And can we join?
And how many more people have said to you, I wish I had done something and listened and followed my heart?
Well, that's, I think, what drove the trip. I don't want to be one of those people.
Yeah, exactly. And you're not going to be one of those, Tim. All the best to you, my friend. Send me a postcard.
Mark, thanks so much. It's been fun.
Namaste, my friend. All the best to you. My name is Mark Farrell. The show is Insight. If you missed an earlier episode, it's always on PRN.fm, or if you want to hear an earlier part of this particular show, go under the Insight page. If you'd like me to speak at your school, college, organization, or corporation, log on to MarkFarrellMotivation.com, MarkFarrellMotivation.com. Have a great day. Gary Noel's next. Enjoy!